Let me begin once again by stating what temporality is not. It is not chronology, as opposed to history, and it is not history, as opposed to chronology. By chronology, I mean any regular system of dated time intervals in which events are said to have taken place. By history, I mean any series of events which may be dated in time according to their occurrence in one or another chronological interval. Thus, the Battle of Hastings was a historical event. 1066 was a date marking the interval of a year, and records tell us that the former occurred in the latter. In the mere succession of dates, there are no events, because everything repeats. In the mere succession of events, there is no time, as nothing does. The relation between chronology and history in this conception has been well expressed. Without change, there is no history. Without regularity, there is no time. Time and history are related as rule and variation. Time is the regular setting for the vagaries of history. Now, in introducing the concept of temporality, I do not intend that it should stand as a third term alongside the concepts of chronology and history. For in the sense in which I shall use the term here, temporality entails a perspective that contrasts radically with the one outlined above, that sets up history and chronology in a relation of complementary opposition. Recall last week, we spoke of the A series, in which time is imminent in the passage of events, and the B series, in which events are strung out in time like beads on a thread. Whereas in the B series, events are treated as isolated happenings, succeeding one another frame by frame. Each event in the A series is seen to encompass a pattern of retentions from the past and protentions for the future. Thus, from the A series point of view, temporality and historicity are not opposed, but rather merge in the experience of those who, in their activities, carry forward the process of social life. Some public school educators interrogate me for performing in a respectful tone, allow legend that explains the lunar eclipse as a frog in the sky who swallows the moon. After one performance, I was asked, "How do the Lao react when you tell them they are wrong?" When I replied that I do not correct my Lao friends about their understanding of the lunar eclipse, the audience was aghast. Some stormed out, but some stayed to chastise me. I've been faulted for not correcting the grammar and pronunciation of the narrative texts I've collected, and thus making the people sound stupid and backward. Weeks after a performance, I've received letters from people telling me how angry they were, that they couldn't sleep when thinking about the performance, and that it had given them bad dreams, such as the one of a fox which was crossing a river, carried into a deep gully, and all his efforts to get out were unavailing. Besides all the other suffering that he had to endure, he was tormented by a swarm of ticks which fastened on him. A hedgehog that was on his travels came up and was sorry for him, and asked if he should pick off the ticks. "No, please don't," replied the fox. "Why not?" said the hedgehog. "Because these have already made a good meal on me, and don't suck much blood now. But if you take them away, another lot will come, all hungry, and drain every drop of blood I have left." The North Pole is our canary in a coal mine, literally, as the effects of forced anthropogenic warming affect the delicate ecosystem more extremely than climates closer to the equator. Slight rises in temperature at the pole are more significant than similar temperature differences are near the equator. The phenomena resulting from climate crisis factors, such as temperature rise, increased albedo effect, rising sea levels, etc., multiply and cause secondary phenomena in a process that cannot be slowed and will continue for many centuries, even if we were to stop producing greenhouse gases today. These possible effects of the rapidly transforming boreal climate keep us hooked up to the morphine drip of cataclysmic prophecies, Imagine London totally submerged. Imagine tidal waves destroying Japan. Imagine the ice sheet that covers virtually all of Greenland just slipping off into the sea. Witness the invaluable data found in mile-long ice cores carefully screwed out from deep within ancient ice sheets and glaciers. So this mythical place, once our most remote, our most inaccessible landscape, is now almost on our doorstep, and it is irrevocably connected to very real, even quantifiable daily human life in the not-so-distant future. A classic and typical image is this one from Jane Eyre. Aesop is holding a hammer in one hand, a metalworker's tool, with which he seems to be gesticulating for the edification or amusement of the animal seated upright on its haunches opposite him. It seems that the two of them are engaged in a dialogue, and the objects on which they are seated, Aesop looking perplexed, the animal gaily waving its forepaws, are anvils. I grew up in a little white house at the very edge of a small town in northwest Ohio. Beside our house, my parents had planted a few years before my birth a cut-leaf weeping birch tree, Betula pendula lacinata, a transplant from Europe, as my ancestors had been. The lacinata refers to its small, many-pointed, lacy leaves. As a child, I loved to stand under the weeping threads of its branches, next to the slim white trunk. Its young bark was thin and crinkly as tissue paper and revealed to my toddler fingers the joys of peeling things. In junior high, sent to rake the birch tree's generous fall of yellow leaves, I would rake and daydream, sometimes arranging the leaves in the rectangles and squares of a floor plan, with windows and doorways laid out as in blueprints. Later in high school, I sat beneath the now 30-foot-tall tree on summer afternoons, immersed in books. I cannot say I shared secrets with the tree, but I did feel different, calmer, a little more confident or clear after being veiled for a few hours under its leafy fall. 15 years out of high school, when I was in my early 30s and living in Oakland, California, the birch tree became a friend in a new way. One evening I was startled by something I had never before experienced. I was having to get used to a lot of changes. About 6 months earlier, I had fallen ill with a flu that had left me feeling as if 20-pound weights were strapped to each limb. Every step took considerable effort. I could feel but not see that our hillside flat flowed ever so slightly downward, because walking across the living room floor was easier in one direction than the other. One evening, as I headed downhill on the floor after dinner, an image jumped to mind. It was the birch tree, and in the space of a moment the tree was as present inside my head as the sofa was present before my body. I sank down and closed my eyes. What was happening? I had not thought of the birch tree for years, and had no reason to be thinking of it now. There was no announcement, there were no words. The tree simply rose in my awareness, its tall, graceful image strong in my mind, stronger somehow than a memory. The presence remained vivid for a few moments and then gradually faded. A feeling of quiet gravity, almost sadness, accompanied it. A few weeks later, I received a call from my brother, who still lived in our hometown in Ohio. We talked a few minutes before he said slowly, "Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to cut down the birch tree. It's got a disease or something." I hung up the phone full of wonder. So the birch tree had come to say goodbye. I knew the birch tree very well from my years of living with it. What I had not realized until then was that the birch tree also knew me. Let me begin once again by stating what temporality is not. It is not chronology as opposed to history, and it is not history as opposed to chronology. And the sting consists of three parts: a stylus and two barbed slides, or lancets, one on either side of the stylus. A bee does not push its sting in, but it is drawn in by the barbed slides. The slides move alternately up and down the stylus, so when the barb of one slide has caught and retracts, it pulls the stylus and the other barbed slide into the wound. When the other barb has caught, it also retracts up the stylus, pulling the sting further in. This process is repeated until the sting is fully in, and even continues after the sting and its mechanism is detached from the bee's abdomen. Ask the question, was Aesop an ugly man in his physical makeup? Tradition has pictured the teller of the jaunty fables as a small, misshapen human being, a wry-mannered entertainer who seduces the mind with his fantastic tales about men and beasts. The grotesque image pleased the ancients. It persisted through the Middle Ages. But this idea of deformity has become repellent, apparently, to the modern, more scientific and scholarly age. So much so that Aesop's ugliness is dismissed by good authority as mere fiction. And along with it, often enough, the very existence of the man himself, taken back to the city, put in irons, locked in a dungeon, and then condemned to be stoned from the cliff. Unable to defend himself with ordinary weapons, he tried fables and was mocked for them. A frog, he told them, had invited a mouse to come and see her. In order to ferry the mouse over the pond, the frog tied him to her foot, but once they were on the water, she tried to drag him to the bottom, meaning to drown him and make a meal of him afterwards. In his distress, the mouse fought back as best he could. A bird of prey, seeing him thrashing the water, swooped down and carried him off together with the frog, who couldn't get loose, and feasted on them, the one and the other. But we should resist the temptation to assume that since stories are stories, they are in some sense unreal or untrue. For this is to suppose that the only real reality, or true truth, is one in which we, as living, experiencing beings, can have no part at all. Telling a story is not like weaving a tapestry to cover up the world. It is rather a way of guiding the attention of listeners or readers into it. A person who can tell is one who is perceptually attuned to picking up information in the environment that others, less skilled in the tasks of perception, might miss. And the teller, in rendering his knowledge explicit, conducts the attention of his audience along the same paths as his own. Following that preamble, I shall now return to the bee. When a honeybee stings a person, it cannot pull the barbed stinger back out. It leaves behind not only the stinger, but also part of its abdomen and digestive tract, plus muscles and nerves. This massive abdominal rupture is what kills the honeybee. Honeybees are the only species of bees to die after stinging. As with music, the forms of the landscape are generated in movement. These forms, however, are congealed in a solid medium. A landscape is the most solid appearance in which a history can declare itself. Thanks to their solidity, features of the landscape remain available for inspection long after the movement that gave rise to them has ceased. Every object is to be regarded as a collapsed act. The landscape as a whole must likewise be understood as the taskscape in its embodied form, a pattern of activities collapsed into an array of features. But to reiterate a point made earlier, the landscape takes on its forms through a process of incorporation, not of inscription. That is to say, the process is not one whereby cultural design is imposed upon a naturally given substrate, as though the movement issued from the form and was completed in its concrete realization in the material. For the forms of the landscape arise alongside those of the taskscape, within the same current of activity. If we recognize a man's gait in the pattern of his footprints, it is not because the gait preceded the footprints and was inscribed in them, but because both the gait and the prints arose within the movement of the man's walking. Since, moreover, the activities that comprise the taskscape are unending, the landscape is never complete, neither built nor unbuilt, perpetually under construction. This is why the conventional dichotomy between natural and artificial, or man-made, components of the landscape is so problematic. For both the archaeologist and the native dweller, the landscape tells, or rather is, a story. It enfolds the lives and times of predecessors who, over the generations, have moved around in it and played their part in its formation. To perceive the landscape is therefore to carry out an act of remembrance. And remembering is not so much a matter of calling up an internal image stored in the mind, as of engaging perceptually with an environment that is itself pregnant with the past. The Fox says that this ability to co-create is what defines an animist world. Animacy, he says, is the condition of being alive to the world, characterized by a heightened sensitivity and responsiveness in perception and action to an environment that is always in flux, never the same from one moment to the next. Beings of all kinds continually and reciprocally bring one another into existence. One catches from his words a sense of the dynamic interplay that is creating the world, and each being within it, afresh in every moment. Each being, by contributing its own characteristic movement and creativity, shapes all the other beings in its vicinity, and so shapes the world. To illustrate this relational constitution of being, which he bases on indigenous animisms, the Fox contrasts the bounded self of the Cartesian framework, pictured as a circle, with the self drawn as a wavy line moving forward, like the track of an animal through the underbrush. The circle is static, with an inside and an outside, a me and not me. The wavy line has no such boundary, but instead indicates direction, movement, change. The drawings translate into differing conceptions of a being. Instead of a fox categorized as an animal with four legs and orange fur, in the words of the Koyukon of Alaska, a fox is streaking like a flash of fire through the undergrowth. Likewise, the birch tree might become not a 30-foot-tall tree with white bark and lacy leaves, but rather, standing tall, emitting soft rustles through weeping threads. One recognizes another being not by its static attributes, but by its unique way of moving in the world. Each movement, each track or trail, implies an interconnection with the tracks of others. Every such trail traces a relation. Each being, each track, intersects with other tracks, continually creating a tissue of trails that together make up the texture of the life world, not a network, but a meshwork. Such a depiction of personhood as a trail moving through life stretches the limits of a noun-based language such as English. And it is no accident that the languages of many animist cultures, including those of indigenous North America, are verb-based. A verb-based language mutes the distinction between subject and object, first and foremost in the construction of the sentence, where those two positions do not exist. All beings are implicitly actors, subsumed in the activity of the verb. The message that everything is evolving and in movement is communicated through each sentence, in contrast with languages such as Greek and English, which train the attention to perceive discrete objects and their static attributes. The dung beetle is hidden from sight at first, but the servants starting in and out, feeding him his ordure, make it quite clear that they've got a really remarkable bug penned up back there, one that their master has been at great pains to seek out for his trip. The dung beetle, I remind you, is the only earthly creature that has ever reached the gods, as you should know from the fable of Aesop. This species of beetle figures in other fables. Its fascination for the Greeks may be related to the fascination of the scarab to the Egyptians. The bug calls attention to itself by its fantastic habit of kicking a ball of dung up a sunny, dusty slope and letting it roll down again until the ball has become a good, big, round mass. This will house eggs and become a commissary for the younger generation, or, for that matter, according to other fables, for any beetles who find themselves in need. This phenomenal activity, reduced to its essentials of the sun and the earth and the sphere, suggested to the Egyptians anyhow spontaneous creation. That I experience the birch tree as communicating with me both is and is not the issue. Yes, it constitutes the central problematic in what follows here, an image of cross-species connection that provokes reflection on and critical thinking about relations between humans and other beings in the world. But my purpose here is not to explain or justify my interpretation of the event, much less to convince others of the possibility of human-tree communication. Although I discuss such communication, I do not construct an apologetic for it. I hold that worldviews are not straightforwardly verifiable or falsifiable, which means that attempts at convincing others of their believability are misplaced at best. Yet the issue is indeed one of worldviews. That I experienced the birch tree as communicating with me indicates that I had crossed a border separating a modern Western worldview from the alternatives. Modern and Western here both refer to a worldview dependent on the body-spirit, human nature, and subject-object dualisms characterizing the scientific revolution and enlightenment of 17th and 18th century Europe, as well as the discourses and practices, such as those of the industrialized West and North derived from that history. The modern worldview is characterized by the double separation between humans and non-humans on the one hand, and between what happens above and what happens below on the other. We have never been modern. My experience of receiving communication from a tree stands as an example of the failure of the modernizing enterprise and the persistence of pre-modern, anti-modern, or non-modern worldviews within and alongside modernity. 1. Longitudinal extension. 2. A slender string. 3. A thread extended to direct any operations. 4. The string that sustains the angler's hook. 5. Lineaments or marks in the hands or face. 6. Delineation sketch. 7. Contour outline. 8. As much as is written from one margin to the other, a verse. 9. Rank. 10. Work thrown up, trench. 11. Method disposition. 12. Extension limit. 13. Equator. Equinoctial circle. 14. Progeny, family, ascending or descending. 15. 1/10 of an inch. 16. A letter, as in, I read your lines. 17. Lint or flax.